Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Litigation and Corporation Securities and Antitrust Practice Groups, was recorded on Wednesday, April 8, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on shifting from the district court action to administrative proceedings at the Securities and Exchange Commission. My name is Christian Corrigan, and I'm the Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call, and also that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're pleased to welcome our expert, Mr. Matthew T. Martins, who is currently a litigation partner at WilmerHale in Washington, D.C. Before joining WilmerHale, Mr. Martins was the SEC's chief litigation counsel. In that role, he prevailed as the SEC's lead trial counsel in the case against former Goldman Sachs trader Fabrice Touré. Earlier in his career, Mr. Martins was an assistant U.S. attorney, the chief of staff to the U.S. Assistant Attorney General Michael Chertoff, and a law clerk to then Chief Justice William Rehnquist of the United States Supreme Court. More complete bio of Mr. Martins is available in the email that was sent to you and on our website, so I'll stop there for his presentation, followed by your questions. So, Mr. Martins, the floor is yours.
Thanks so much for that. So I wanted to talk today a little bit about what's been in the news recently concerning the SEC's expressed desire to shift more of its enforcement actions to administrative proceedings. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the statements that commission officials have made with regard to that, the differences between administrative proceeding and district court actions that the SEC might bring, and then talk about some of the constitutional challenges that parties have brought contesting the SEC's decision to shift in this direction. So just as a matter of history, the commission has had the authority since the founding of the agency back in the 30s to bring enforcement actions against violators of the federal securities laws. Initially, that power was primarily exercised in district courts, and it was generally limited to injunctive power. I'm speaking in generalities there. Over time, the agency has received the ability to obtain penalties against violators of the securities laws. But again, generally speaking, the power to get penalties was limited to district court actions, except in the case of individuals who are regulated, individuals or entities. In that instance, the SEC had the ability to get penalties in administrative proceedings. But Dodd-Frank changed the landscape significantly because as a result of Dodd-Frank, the SEC essentially has the same ability to obtain penalties, monetary penalties, against violators of the securities laws in administrative proceedings as it does in district court actions. And so what that does ultimately is provide the SEC with a meaningful choice between bringing a matter in district court as opposed to bringing a matter in an administrative proceeding. Now the SEC can obtain essentially the same relief regardless of the forum it chooses. As a result, there have been statements by a variety of SEC officials that they intend to use the administrative proceeding power more extensively. The director of the Enforcement Division, Andrew Ceresni, said that, quote, we're using administrative proceedings more extensively because they offer a streamlined process with sophisticated fact finders. And similarly, the head of the FCPA unit at the SEC said it's fair to say that it's the new normal to move toward administrative proceedings more frequently. And even the CFTC, sister agency to the SEC, has stated their intent to make the same shift. Aitman Goldman, the director of the CFTC's Division of Enforcement, said, quote, the overwhelming reason for this change is the agency's lack of resources, including its bandwidth for discovery-intense litigation. And so this shift has raised significant concern among members of the defense bar. And much of the concern is driven by the fact that administrative proceedings are significantly different than district court actions. While ultimately the SEC can obtain essentially the same remedies, including multi-million dollar financial penalties and industry bars and in administrative proceedings. The protections for respondents, which is the name for a defendant in those proceedings, are much more limited. And I'm going to talk about several ways in which the proceedings are different. The first of all is that in administrative proceedings, the discovery available to the respondent is much more limited. In an administrative proceeding, an AP, I'll call it, the respondent is entitled to obtain a copy of the agency's investigative file within 7 days, but there are no depositions. There's no right to propound document requests. To the extent that you can subpoena documents, it's only based on subpoenas that are approved in advance by the administrative law judge presiding over the hearing. And there's no rule for expert discovery in the same way as in federal district court. There's no provision for expert reports in the rule other than a requirement that each side provide a brief summary of what the expected expert testimony will be. And even then, there's no depositions of those experts or Daubert motions or the like. So the discovery is much more limited. It's much more akin to a situation like a federal criminal case where you're entitled to the documents that the government has collected, but otherwise there's not much of a discovery mechanism prior to the hearing itself. With regard, another way in which APs and district court actions are different is the speed with which the case moves to a hearing in an administrative proceeding. So there's a statutory requirement that certain types of administrative proceedings be brought to a hearing within no more than 60 days, absent the consent of the parties. And at most, the rules provide that a case must proceed to a hearing within 120 days of it being initiated. This is a significant issue for respondents. Just to take one recent case, the respondent was provided with 22 million pages of documentary discovery by the SEC and had to go to a hearing within 120 days of the case being filed. As the respondent pointed out, the printed discovery in that case was larger than the printed Library of Congress, and yet he was forced into a hearing in a relatively short period of time. So this is a significant issue, the speed with which the case moves to a hearing, because it limits the ability of a respondent to build their case, despite the fact that the SEC can typically spend up to 5 years, which is the statute of limitations, developing their evidentiary record. A third way in which APs and district court actions differ is with regard to motions practice. The SEC's rules of practice don't provide for either motions to dismiss or motions for summary judgment in administrative proceedings. There is something called a motion for summary disposition, but it is rarely used as a way to dismiss the case or resolve the case, at least for in the favor of a respondent prior to the hearing. Another way in which the case differs is the fact finder. Unlike a federal district court action where the fact finder will usually be a jury, because the Supreme Court has said there's a jury trial right in most cases brought in federal district court, in an administrative proceeding brought by the SEC, the fact finder is an administrative law judge who is an SEC employee. Another way in which the cases differ is with regard to the rules of evidence. In federal district court, there's obviously rules limiting what can be admitted, not only based on relevance, but also whether it might be more prejudicial than probative. There's limits on the use of hearsay evidence and the like. In administrative proceedings, essentially anything that can be useful to the administrative law judge can come in. Typically, there's not a need to lay foundation for documents when they're introduced through a witness, and hearsay is admissible in district court actions. And there's no limitation on expert testimony akin to Daubert. A sixth way in which administrative proceedings and district court actions differs with regard to review of the decision by the administrative law judge. So typically at the end of an administrative proceeding, an ALJ will issue a written decision that has both findings of fact and legal analysis that can then be reviewed on appeal, on a petition for review to the SEC, the commission itself, meaning to the five commissioners who approved bringing the action in the first instance. This has obviously raised a great deal of concern among respondents, since the right of appeal is to the same body that approved bringing the action in the first instance. The review by the commission is de novo. The commission can order additional evidence to be heard, though typically what happens is it's more akin to an oral argument before an appellate court, where the parties argue in front of the five commissioners. After the commission then issues its decision, there is review to a federal appellate court. On that review, the federal securities laws provide that factual findings by the commission are deemed conclusive if supported by substantial evidence, and legal holdings by the commission are, it appears, subject to Chevron deference. There's been some dispute about that recently, but I think the majority position is that there's Chevron deference to the commission's legal findings, legal holdings, whether that's interpretation of the federal securities statutes or its rules. There's also been some recent developments concerning what type of res judicata effect a decision by the commission has. In that respect, the Supreme Court just last week issued a decision called B&B Hardware versus Hargis Industries, which seems to hold that administrative decisions can have res judicata effect even in subsequent district court actions. And so it would be interesting to see how that is applied, if at all, to SEC administrative proceedings. Because of concerns that parties have had about the way in which administrative proceedings are conducted, there have been a number of challenges brought in federal court to the constitutionality of the SEC's expanded use of administrative proceedings. One of the threshold questions raised in these challenges is, what is the proper forum in which to bring these challenges? At least, by my count, 10 individuals or entities have brought actions seeking to, in some way, enjoin an administrative proceeding before it gets going or from its outset. So they brought affirmative district court actions suing the SEC seeking to block an administrative proceeding. The issue that the district courts have had to wrestle with in that circumstance is whether or not they have jurisdiction to hear these lawsuits seeking to block administrative proceedings, given that Congress has provided a mechanism to challenge the findings of the commission in administrative proceedings by appealing up to a federal circuit court. And the primary case in this area that addresses this issue is a Supreme Court case called Thunder Basin, a 1994 Supreme Court case, which generally seems to suggest that to the extent there's a congressionally provided mechanism for appellate review, that district courts don't have jurisdiction to consider challenges to forestall an administrative proceeding. And at least that's the way most district courts have interpreted Thunder Basin. So while there have been 10 cases to date in which respondents have sought to forestall a administrative proceeding, only one of them has gotten past the motion to dismiss stage, the case of Rajat Gupta versus the SEC, in which the plaintiff there, Mr. Gupta, challenged his administrative proceeding on the ground that it violated equal protection because he was mistreated as a class of one. Since then, other courts have rejected the Gupta analysis, and it seems that that may be a one-off situation. In the 9 subsequent cases, none of the cases have made it past a motion to dismiss. All of them are still at the district court stage except for 2 of them, one of them in the D.C. Circuit, where the court recently held oral argument, and one that's on appeal in the 7th Circuit right now. The legal claims, the constitutional claims that have been raised in these proceedings fall into five different categories. One of which is a Seventh Amendment jury trial argument, in which potential respondents in an administrative proceeding argue that by putting a case in the administrative forum rather than in the district court, they're denied what would be their right in the district court to a jury trial on the issue of liability. This argument seems to be foreclosed by a Supreme Court case from 1977 called Atlas Roofing Company versus OSHA, but presumably the respondents are advancing this argument in the hope that the Supreme Court will ultimately revisit the ability of Congress to put administrative cases in put cases that where there would be a jury trial right in an administrative forum. Another argument being raised by respondent is a challenge to the ability of Congress to take a case away from the judiciary and put it into an Article I forum. Again, the Supreme Court has well-established precedent on this, most recently in a case called Stern versus Marshall in the Supreme Court, which articulated which types of cases can be put in non-Article III forums. And it seems that this is, again, a difficult argument for respondents to make given the Supreme Court precedent in this area. Another argument made more recently by a few of the respondents who have brought district court actions against the SEC is an argument under the Article I Take Care Clause, where the executive branch, in particular the president, has the authority or the responsibility to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. In a case back in 2010 called Free Enterprise Fund versus the PCAOB, the Supreme Court limited the ability of the executive and the legislative branch to put particular responsibilities in the hands of executive branch officials who have tenure protection from presidential removal. So the issue in Free Enterprise Fund was that there were officials at the PCAOB, the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board, who had tenure protection and who reported up to the SEC commissioners who had tenure protection. And in Free Enterprise Fund, the Supreme Court said that those two levels of tenure protection for inferior officers who were carrying out the law violated the Take Care Clause because it unduly limited the president's ability to have responsibility for those PCAOB officials. The question is whether or not that decision has application to administrative proceedings, namely whether or not administrative law judges are similarly inferior officers and whether they have tenure protection that is similar to that found problematic in the Free Enterprise Fund case. And then if so, what's the remedy? In the Free Enterprise Fund case, the remedy the court ordered was not the disbandment of the PCAOB, but was instead the removal of the tenure protection, the striking down of the tenure protection. And so it's not clear whether this line of attack would result in limiting the ability to bring cases in administrative proceedings, even if it was successful, or whether it would just change the tenure protections of administrative law judges. A fourth line of argument that respondents have raised is a due process argument. This has generally not been raised as a facial challenge, but instead as applied, arguing that in their particular facts and circumstances, the way in which the administrative proceedings are run, the limited discovery, the lack of time to prepare, and the unusual rules of evidence, as applied to their case, they argue violate due process. It's unclear yet how this argument will play out, as no court has had the opportunity yet to rule on such a claim. And then finally, there have been Fifth Amendment equal protection claims raised where a respondent believes that they have been singled out in an unusual way as compared to other similarly situated respondents, and they have had their case put in administrative proceedings while other similarly situated parties have been named as defendants in federal district court actions. As I mentioned before, this argument was most prominently made by Rajat Gupta, who was charged initially with insider trading and administrative proceeding, as compared to other inside traders in the same scheme who were all charged in federal district court. I think 28 of them charged in federal district court as compared to him. So those are the primary lines of attack that respondents have made to the administrative proceedings, all of them constitutional arguments. Congress has recently gotten into the fray as well in a House hearing, House Financial Services Subcommittee hearing earlier last month. Chairman Scott Garrett of that committee questioned SEC Enforcement Director Serezny about the decision to move away from district court and into these administrative proceedings. And there was a lot of questioning surrounding the fact that the SEC has touted its perfect record last year in administrative proceedings. And the Congress has been asking questions about whether this raises questions of fairness to respondents, whether the proceedings are really geared toward the types of cases that the SEC is now bringing in those fora. So that's the summary that I have now, and I'm happy to take any questions.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that excellent presentation. We'll now open the floor to our audience questions. In a moment, you will hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. So again, if you'd like to ask a question, press star and then the pound key. Looks like we did have one question jump on the line.
Hi.
Yes, go ahead.
Hi, Chris Ciccone up in Boston, Deutsche Asset Management. Just wondering, when you said that they're moving towards this administrative procedure process rather than district court simply because of manpower. Wouldn't that be, and this is a speculative question, wouldn't that sort of resonate with like a justice like Scalia, where he might side with the little guy or the respondent, saying, look, it's too bad that the government doesn't have enough resources. They should be able to provide the resources. It's, you know, you shouldn't be suffer because of what the government, because of government convenience. Does that sound like a plausible argument?
So I think that quote that that you referenced and that I recited earlier was from the CFTC's enforcement director, though it appears that similar judgments are being made by the SEC. In terms of whether or not that argument would resonate with a particular justice, it's hard to tell. I say that because balanced against that argument is one of prosecutorial discretion. And so taking Justice Scalia, for example, he's been historically very deferential to the discretion that the executive branch has, particularly in areas of making judgments about what cases to bring and how to bring them. And in one of the cases in particular where a respondent brought a district court action challenging that type of decision, the court pointed out that those type of judgments about where to bring a proceeding and how to bring it is a type of discretionary decision that's uniquely entrusted to the executive branch. So it's hard to predict how sort of cross currents of arguments, some of which might appeal to a particular justice, but some of which might run against the leanings of a particular justice, would ultimately be balanced and resolved. So it's a very interesting issue because there's competing arguments that might appeal to one particular justice or another.
All right. Well, our lines are open, so if you'd like to ask a question, press star and then the pound key. And while we're waiting for our next question to jump on, a couple quick programming notes. The first is, for those of you in Washington, D.C., our April 2015 D.C. luncheon with Senator Mike Lee is coming up this Friday, April 10th. He'll be speaking at Tony Chang's restaurant and discussing his new book, Our Lost Constitution. All right, well, it looks like we had two questions jump on the line, and we'll get to both of those.
It seems to me that prosecutorial discretion is much more permitted in the decision not to prosecute than in the decision to prosecute. There should be a lot of prosecutorial discretion in the ability not to prosecute, but in terms of prosecuting, putting it into a mere convenient forum that may not give rights to the defendant seems to border on unconstitutionality. Any comments on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately sort of there's two issues there, which is one is whether or not the proceeding is otherwise unconstitutional, and then if it's constitutional, whether or not there's judicial review for the decision to choose between one venue or another. In other words, I don't think the SEC would argue that they're entitled to bring a proceeding in a venue that denies people their constitutional rights. I think what they would argue is this venue doesn't deny them their constitutional rights. And so what we're left with is a question of deciding between two constitutional fora, one of which is in a given case more advantageous to the SEC than another. So if I'm playing devil's advocate, I think that's their argument. And they would say, we're entitled in any case to decide how to bring the case in the way that we believe is the best allocation of our resources and that brings the most likelihood of success. And at least in the case of Wing Chao versus the SEC, which was decided by the Southern District of New York, Judge Kaplan last December, that's exactly the argument he advanced, which he said that to allocate its available funds and personnel in such a way as to execute its policy efficiently and economically is precisely the type of discretionary decision that's left to the executive branch. So
what sort of penalties were imposed on the defendant there? I mean, if he's simply going to lose his SEC license, that's one thing. But if he's going to face prison time or huge fines, he would seem to be entitled to a jury trial.
Right. So in that case, there was, as I recall, over $1 million in monetary relief provided to the SEC when the SEC ultimately prevailed. And so you raise an argument which I think is exactly the one that gives many defense counsel and respondents a lot of heartburn, which is if this case was brought in federal district court, I would have a jury trial right under Tull versus the United States, a Supreme Court case that's been in place for nearly 30 years. And yet somehow that jury trial right can be sidestepped by the simple expedient of moving the case into a administrative proceeding where now I can be subject to crippling financial penalties. And
yeah, I would say $1 million is a little more than $20, which would be the even considering inflation since the Constitution was written.
Yeah, and I think that I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, that's a hefty fine.
Yeah, and I think the problem is the Supreme Court case in Atlas Roofing versus OSHA, which was a 1977 case, which allowed the Congress to put proceedings into administrative fora, even when, if the case was brought in a federal district court, there would be a right to a jury trial. And so, not surprisingly, the SEC is playing on, is riding on the back of, so to speak, that Supreme Court precedent. And as long as that stands, it presents a challenge to respondents who are raising Seventh Amendment jury trial issues.
Thank you.
All right. Well, we have one more pending question, and our lines will be open. So if you'd like to ask one, press star and then the pound key.
Yes, it's David Emerson, a society member in Berkeley, California. I've got a couple of questions, actually. And the first one has to do with, is this an SEC-specific focus that we're discussing, or is it more of a general concern about all administrative agencies which would be inclined to move to an administrative proceeding, notably the EPA, but others as well. And is there something specific about these facts and circumstances and the precedents that are being cited, which limit the discussion here more to the SEC, or is this a general discussion? And then the second question I have refers back to the Atlas case that you just mentioned, about whether or not there have been any precedents which have established limiting principles on the extent of the exposure, I mean, the magnitude of the financial potential fine or prison term, jail term, those types of sentences, similar to what we might have with citations. I mean, a citation-level offense has different due process standards than felonies and misdemeanors.
Sure, so I can take both of those questions. The issue has gotten a lot of attention recently in this SEC, and I would also say CFTC, Commodity Futures Trading Commission, in the context of those administrative proceedings. I think largely because this authority did not exist historically for the most part until the amendments to Dodd-Frank. And so as a practical matter, Dodd-Frank made it more feasible for the SEC to bring these cases. And so I think that's what's generated a lot of the discussion, both in op-ed pieces and these lawsuits. So I think that's been the driving, that's what initiated the possibility that the SEC could do this. And then the SEC's most recent enforcement director, the current enforcement director, has now stated publicly on numerous occasions a desire to use this authority more vigorously than it was used in the past. So even though under the prior enforcement director the authority existed, it wasn't used that much. And so I think it's a combination of this new statutory power combined with SEC officials expressing the intent to use it that has generated a lot of the commentary around this issue. As for Atlas Roofing, I don't think anything in Atlas Roofing would provide that a criminal case could be brought into an administrative proceeding. And I've never heard the government argue that, and I would be frankly shocked if they ever did. And nothing about Atlas Roofing suggests that that would be permissible. As I'm sure you all know, the SEC doesn't have criminal prosecution authority, and so it's really just a matter of civil enforcement authority. As far as I know, there have not been any precedents subsequent to Atlas Roofing in which the Supreme Court is, or any other court, has limited Atlas Roofing based on the extent of the financial exposure that a particular respondent might face. And maybe that's a line of argument that will be made, but to my knowledge, hasn't been made in an effort to limit Atlas Roofing to date.
All right, well, our lines are open, so if you'd like to get on and make a question or comment, press star and then the pound key. Another note, programming note a little farther away for those of you listening, our third annual now Executive Branch Review Conference is coming up in Washington, D.C. this year on June 18th, 2015 at the Mayflower Hotel. More information about that conference, the lineup of speakers and panels, will be posted periodically on our website at fedsoc.org. And it looks like we did have one more question jump on the line.
The million-dollar penalty, if it's not a criminal penalty, where does that come from? Is that only applicable to SEC licensees, or is there some other thing that applies this to everyone?
So beginning in, for the most part, in I believe it was the late 80s or early 90s, the federal securities laws were amended to allow for monetary penalties in certain circumstances. That penalty power has been expanded over time. For the most part, prior to Dodd-Frank, the SEC could only obtain monetary penalties in administrative proceedings if they were brought against regulated entities like broker-dealers. I'm not saying that's an absolute, but more or less that was the rule. And that changed after Dodd-Frank, where the ability to obtain monetary penalties was expanded by statute to be permissible not only in federal district court actions, but also in administrative proceedings. And so that's
so
part,
if you
that's,
started a corporation and had investors, even if you're not an SEC-regulated dealer, the fact that you're bringing in investors subjects you to these rules.
Correct. As Dodd-Frank's now amended the federal securities laws, you could always be subject to financial penalties in a SEC enforcement action if it was brought in federal district court. What's now unique is that you can also be subject to those financial penalties in administrative proceedings, even if you're not a registered SEC broker-dealer, for example. So once
if you had set up Enron and permeated it with fraud, the SEC could go after that.
So the SEC has been able to pursue enforcement actions since the creation of the agency back in the 30s. The penalty power in federal district court actions arose, I believe, either in the late 80s or 90s. But it generally would have to be brought in district court against somebody who was just, say, an executive at a company that was committing accounting fraud. Now, at least under the statute, such a case could be brought in an administrative proceeding. And monetary penalties could be imposed in that proceeding.
Okay, well, we have another call on the line that we'll get to. And again, if you'd like to get in line to ask a question after this one, they'll be open, star and then the pound key. Oh, looks like we lost our question that we had. So if that caller wants to go ahead and press star and the pound key again, we'll get you back on the line.
Hi. So I've just been listening to a few questions, and in the answer to one question, you said, well, the SEC does not have any criminal authority, and you don't think that'll ever really happen to bring that before their own ALJ. And in the next thing, you say, well, but before their own ALJ, they can seek penalties of, say, $1 million or so. What is the theory under which that's not criminal? Is the theory that, well, if we just call it civil, that makes it civil rather than criminal? $1 million penalty?
So the issue of whether a monetary penalty is civil or criminal is in part dependent on how Congress labels it. So Congress has deemed these to be civil monetary penalties. I believe there's been a series of Supreme Court cases raising the issue of whether or not monetary penalties can be deemed, for example, criminal for double jeopardy purposes. I believe that's the context in which the issue's arisen. And there's two Supreme Court cases, one called Halper, H-L-P-E-R, and the other called Hudson. And I believe those two cases address how a court should determine whether or not a penalty that's deemed civil by Congress as enacted should be nonetheless deemed criminal by the courts. And I think the takeaway from that line of cases is that, for the most part, the way in which Congress characterizes the penalty will determine whether or not it's a civil or criminal penalty. I'm not aware of any effort by any legislature to deem imprisonment a civil penalty. And as a result, I would be surprised if there was some effort to give that power to the SEC.
All right, and we have one more question to get to, and then our lines will be open.
Good afternoon. In your opening remarks, you referenced that there's no motion to dismiss, no summary judgment provisions that are in place under this procedure, although there's a dispositive, some type of summary dismissal proceeding. My question goes to, apart from the dispositive motion practice, what the timeline is for a respondent to be in the firing line. And the thought here is, does this administrative process contemplate an expedited proceeding, or are we looking at something which doesn't have the limits which are afforded by district court litigation? That is, like to say, number of depositions, number of subpoenas, timeline for investigation to turn into prosecution. Is there a sunset and timeline to constrain the SEC for how long they keep a respondent's feet to the fire?
So there's a number of timelines that would apply. So the first of which is the SEC has a statute of limitations on bringing a case in which they're seeking penalties. And so the courts have ruled that there's a strict 5-year statute of limitation on between the time a violation occurs and the time the SEC needs to initiate the action. And the Supreme Court interpreted that timeline as not having a discovery-based extension built into it. And that decision was called Gabelli versus the SEC, which the Supreme Court decided, I think, maybe 3 years ago. Then after an administrative proceeding is initiated, there are very strict time limits on the time allowed before a case has to move to an administrative proceeding, and it's usually somewhere between 30 and 120 days after the filing. So the case is moved to a hearing very quickly, and then the rules also provide a very tight timeline for the administrative law judge to then issue his or her decision. The presumptive period is no more than 300 days after the initiation of the case. So if you take a case that's filed today, as a general rule under the SEC's rules, it would go to a hearing in no more than 120 days, and you'd have a decision no more than 300 days from now, so in about 10 months. The deadline for issuing the decision can be extended and occasionally is extended for some limited additional period of time. But for the most part, the administrative law judges issue decisions pretty promptly. There's then a right to appeal to the SEC, to the commission itself, from the administrative law judge's decision. And that appeal can often lag for years. And so there have been cases where the SEC has had them briefed and they have sat before the SEC for nearly 3 years before they ultimately render a decision, even though they're supposed to render decisions more promptly than that. And then there's a right to appellate review after that. So there are some rules that make the front end of the process move quicker, but then it can move more slowly at the back end on the appeal to the SEC.
Just as a follow-up, the Gabelli decision, I'm not an SEC practitioner. Was that particular to the SEC under its own statute, or are you talking about general administrative fines and penalties?
So there's a statute that's 28 U.S.C. 2462, which is a general statute of limitations for cases in which the government seeks penalties. It's not unique to the SEC. That the case in which that decision was applied was unique to the SEC. It was an SEC enforcement case, and thus the name Gabelli versus SEC. But it's a generally applicable statute of limitations for government penalty proceedings.
Okay. One last follow-up, because I think what we're seeing outside, and I'm talking outside of the CFTC or the SEC context, injunctive orders or things which may not be construed as a penalty, but perhaps being paired with an onerous obligation, like a third party being required to be auditing or reviewing what is done by the respondent in response to, say, a cease and desist order. Is there a line recently that you're aware of which relates to where agency requirements go beyond the injunctive and into the penalty phase outside of the monetary context? And what I'm saying is where the agency, like the SEC, CFTC, outside of those two, maybe, or maybe those two included, may have been construed as a penalty, because, say, you have to hire an independent third party to audit your books. That cost is going to require you to retain somebody for $100,000 for, say, 20 years. If you can comment, if that makes sense.
Yep. There's a line of cases that has held that 2462, to the extent it refers to penalties, it's not necessarily limited to monetary penalties. And I believe the leading case on that is one from the D.C. Circuit. If I'm remembering correctly, the name is Johnson versus the SEC. There's also been some litigation on this recently, and I believe that SIFMA filed a brief, I want to say in the 11th Circuit maybe, arguing that the word penalties as used in Section 2462 should be read more broadly than just civil monetary penalties, but covers other types of conduct, other types of remedies that penalize the conduct at issue. So there's at least the Johnson case from the D.C. Circuit, and there's been some other litigation surrounding this in recent months.
Was that SEC versus Johnson?
I think it's Johnson versus SEC.
Thank you.
Yep.
Interesting.
All right. Well, our lines are open, so if you have any final questions that you'd like to ask of our expert, please press star and then the pound key. All right, looks like we had one more jump on.
Hi. I just have a couple quick questions. First, is the win rate for respondents so dismal in the administrative proceedings that basically if you're brought into the administrative process 100% of the time you're going to lose before the SEC and your only shot is before a federal appellate court? And if so, has anyone thought of a due process challenge under this case with Roe v. Larkin, which upheld the combination of investigative and adjudicative functions in one agency, but it did note that, you know, if there was enough suggested, if there's enough empirical evidence and that the facts and circumstances warrant, it might be a due process violation.
So I think the answer to that is that it is certainly a disadvantageous situation to be in an administrative proceeding because of the challenging procedural hurdles, in particular the very short time frame and the limited discovery. At the same time, I don't think I would go so far as to say that it's a lost cause if you are in an administrative proceeding. I think there's a number of tactics that you can take advantage of in some of those proceedings. And I think while the SEC's win rate, as they tout it, has been quite high in administrative proceedings, some of the wins that they count are cases where they did win a charge but lost the vast majority of their case. And so I think that I wouldn't go so far as to say it's a lost cause, but I would say it's a very challenging forum.
Thank you.
All right. Well, we have a few minutes left, so let's do a last call for questions. If you'd like to ask any final questions of our expert, Matthew Martins, press star and then the pound key. Well, it looks like we've exhausted all of our questions. So on behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank Mr. Martins for being here today with us, for giving a great presentation. Thank you to the audience for your questions, for a whole host of very good questions and a great discussion here. A reminder that if you missed any part of this podcast or just want to listen to it again, you can listen to the recording of this on our website, usually up within a couple days at fedsoc.org. And there you can also find the list of all of our scheduled teleforum conference calls. So until next time, we're adjourned. Thank you all so much for being with us.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.